Hey, everybody. Thank you for coming out today. I'm Rufus Griscom, and I'm the moderator today. And I've gathered from the South by Southwest sort of instructions for panelists, which strike me as very prudent, that it's my job to represent the interests of the people today and make sure that these fine panelists don't engage in too much boosterism and self-aggrandizement, which would be natural given the great publications they run and the subject matter of the panel discussion today.
Instead, we'll just rail against the other publications.
Yeah, we're hoping to. Well, we're a little also concerned about, you know, there's some competitiveness with like two, you know, humor magazines here. And so we're going to try to make sure that doesn't derail the proceedings. So let me go ahead and just introduce the folks we have here. We've got to my right, we've got Sean Mills. Sean is president of The Onion. He joined The Onion in 2001. The Onion was founded, unbelievably, in 1988. And went online in 1996.
Wow.
To his right is Laurel Toby. Laurel is the founder and CEO of Media Bistro, which she launched online in 1997. To her right is Joan Walsh. Joan has been editor-in-chief of Salon since 1998, or has been at Salon since 1998, been editor-in-chief for several years. And Salon was launched in 1995. I founded Nerve.com in 1997, and just last December, we launched a second online magazine, Babbel.com. And I'm mentioning these dates intentionally because...
And Ricky?
Yeah. Oh, I'm
hello?
Sorry. Oh my
Are
gosh,
you starting
Ricky,
the competition now?
How could I forget Ricky?
Ricky wasn't
good
born
God.
Then.
In the future of the online magazine, there's only room for one humor publication, so maybe it's appropriate that you...
Yeah, Sean slipped me a 20 spot to do that, but... and we got Ricky Van Veen all the way on the end. Ricky's editor-in-chief of College Humor, which he co-founded with several other dastardly characters in 2000. I'm mentioning all these dates intentionally because this is an exceedingly old and creaky collection of publications.
Thanks,
Ricky. I did the math, and it's collectively, the average age is 9.2 years old, which, as you know, in internet years is basically several thousand years old. One of the things we've been talking about initially in our conversations is that, we've done, by the way, virtually no preparation whatsoever for this, for your entertainment. We thought it would be more fun this way. The term online magazine sounds kind of archaic, and, you know, we chatted about it, and almost none of us actually use that term, so it's sort of an odd term to have, although we're missing a good one, and, so maybe by the end of this we'll have a new term for it. One that we've come up with tentatively is branded content channel, or BCC, as
boo.
Sean shortened it.
Boo. No.
So we'll see how that plays out.
Just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
So just to get things started, online magazines are kind of Web 1.0 phenomena. I mean, they've obviously been around for a long time. A lot has changed in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years. So first question to the group is, how has your business changed due to the new developments in recent years? And I'd throw out the explosion of blogs and video, the growth of RSS and content aggregators, the growth of user-generated content. Have these changes profoundly affected your product, and have they helped or hurt your business? And I'll say as a preface that, you know, there have been a few whippersnapper upstart companies like YouTube and others that have emerged in the last few years that have distracted a little bit of attention from the preeminence of the online magazine, or BCC, at the center of the internet. And so in some ways, I think there perhaps been some negatives, but there clearly also been a lot of positives. So how do you guys see that? Just jump in.
Jump in? Wait, if we're going to jump in, can I just ask a question about the audience, first of all? Is that okay, Rufus?
Yeah, Laura, go right ahead.
Okay. I want to do a little popularity contest here. How many of you came to see Rufus from Nerve.com? Just clap. Okay. All right. How many of you came to see Sean from The Onion?
Yeah.
All right. I'm not going to include myself in here because that would just be... how many of you came to see Ricky from College Humor? And how many of you came to see Joan from Salon? Wow. All right. How many of you are bloggers out there? Raise your hand. You can raise your hands on that one. If they're not attached to computers. How many of you are here to get educated? Raise your hand. How many of you are here to be entertained? Okay. All right. We've got a lot of work to do here. Joan, I suggest you just do the whole thing. We're just going to ask you questions. No, kidding. All right.
Joan won the popularity contest.
Yeah, she kind of did.
I didn't listen. I have ringers. They're all paid. No, I'll jump in, Rufus. I think whatever we call this Web 2.0 thing has been incredibly great for Salon. I think that, you know, we have a little cheat sheet here, and one of our questions is edited content obsolete? I'm jumping ahead. And clearly, I understand why we're framing it that way, but of course it's not obsolete. I think that the energy of the blogosphere has been incredibly good for Salon, both in terms of driving traffic, sending stories around. I mean, a shameless self-promotion. We had exposed what was going on at Walter Reed Hospital 2 years ago and didn't get the attention that the Washington Post did. And thanks to the blogosphere, I think we really got a piece of that story back, which doesn't only matter so Salon gets credit. It matters that those conditions were exposed 2 years ago and the Bush administration did nothing. But without the blogosphere, the length of that story, the time that it was exposed probably would have gone unnoticed, unless I stood and jumped up and down and yelled really loud, which I did do, but only the blogosphere heard me. So, you know, we've added blogs. We've been letting readers post letters lightly moderated, for about a year and a half. It's been wildly successful. We, take down a handful a day, really. So I think it's all been really great for the online magazine or whatever we call ourselves. And yes, at the center, every day, we hope, is a really well-edited story that tells you something that you didn't know, which is the only reason that you're going to come to Salon, I think, is because we continue to tell stories that other people aren't. So I think it's been really great.
Can you repeat the question? Because I don't think anybody remembers now.
Well, the first question was really how Web 2.0 has changed the way you do business, whether it's affected you positively or negatively. And then I think Joan introduced another interesting theme, which is edited content becoming obsolete?
I think one thing, the site I'm on, College Humor, is a very broad site. When you're doing dick jokes, you appeal to a lot of people. And it's easy for us to get caught up. You know, my friends and I, and probably people here, are more nerdy. And, you know, we talk about social bookmarking and RSS and podcasts. But the truth of the matter is, most people, like in America, don't use RSS. So it's very easy to get caught up in all that stuff. And, you know, when you're pitching advertisers, you can say, you know, we'll put it in our podcast. But, you know, that's not going to be as effective as just putting it on the web for, you know, average Joe to look at.
And does everybody here offer RSS on their sites? Do all the sites have RSS?
Yeah. Yes. Does everybody in the audience subscribe to an RSS? Yes. Okay. So you guys are way ahead of that.
Yeah. And actually, I think this is an interesting subject. Does everybody on the panel send newsletters, whether daily or weekly, to your audience?
Yes,
I think everybody does,
yeah.
Right?
We have a daily.
And it seems to me that that's something that's been kind of under discussed. That is something that one has to struggle to keep in mind. Is that within our own circles of internet savvy people, everybody's all about RSS. For us, newsletters are roughly like 100 times more effective in reaching people than RSS feeds. Although we offer both.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the end. Go ahead.
Okay. Do you want to poll them on something?
No.
Okay.
That's my job here, by the way. They hired me.
The Onion started as a newspaper. And I think I'm the only sort of like started print, went online. And so for years, we were just the newspaper on the internet. And that's really sort of not taking advantage. And so, you know, I'm not really sure what Web 2.0 exactly means. I think it's something to do with the long tail. I'm not really sure.
But tipping point.
The fact is, like, you know, blogs, great. We take advantage of that. We do it a lot on the,
by all means,
the AV Club, which makes a lot more sense than the Onion. But RSS, podcasting, and multimedia, we're We're going to launch a video product in the next couple of weeks. So it's all the above. I think you have to, there's only positive to be gained from all of that. But we haven't done a lot of user generated. I think, to Jonah's point about edited content being obsolete. I think you kind of have to pick your spots. I think there's a place where the blogging makes sense and it's unedited and there's a lot of commenting and that's great. And then I think there's still sort of no replacement for talented writers, and not to say that bloggers and the people that comment aren't really
good
talented
one.
Writers.
That was a good one, Sean.
I'm trying to alienate the blogosphere to them. But my point is we go through a lot of, you know, selection process to find like great comedy writers or great people that can write film reviews that are really talented. And that's not going to be replaced by just a collective editorial process.
Yeah. There's also something to be said for having a full-time staff on end, as opposed to depending on, you know, a bunch of freelancers or a bunch of, you know, random bloggers. If a news event comes up or, you know, Britney Spears does something, you know, we can go right to our writers and say, you need to cover this now, and it'll be on the site.
Is this a dick thing? Like, this big thing happens.
Everything's related.
Yeah, one of my favorite
dick humor, and it happens on the weekend, and everybody's partying. You at least have staff who can cover the dick humor.
Yeah. I remember when Jenna Bush turned 18, George Bush came out and said, you know, by, you know, appeal to the media, do not write about Jenna Bush, and you know, and so of course we asked our writers to come up with a Jenna Bush story right away, and. And one of our writers put together a headline, which was Jenna Bush's federally protected wetlands now open for public drilling. And then you just can't do that without a staff of great writers. So,
hey, Rufus, why don't you ask us all how many staff we have working on editorial content? I'd be curious to know.
Laurel, could you ask everybody? How many do you have, Laurel?
We have 27 people total and about 3 full-time editorial people and then a bunch of freelancers working for us. Oh, and 7 bloggers. At least 7 bloggers. We might have 14 bloggers by now. But 7 blogs.
Wait,
flip to my website, will you?
I know.
Wow.
I mean, he's slow on
like
the,
he's, wow. I think you've given enough time to those other sites. Yeah.
Okay, there you go.
Yes.
And Joan, how about you? How many do you have on staff?
We're massive, Rufus. We're just, we have about 28 people in editorial on staff.
Wow.
And another, we're about at about 60, 64 right now total.
But you charge, right, for subscriptions?
No, Laurel, we don't. That's a sore point. Thanks for bringing that up. No, we're free. You can read Salon for free. We never charge for subscriptions.
That's a lie.
Whatever you heard.
You did.
We charge membership. We have a membership program where people voluntarily give us money because they love us so much and they think we should have money.
How many of you guys have given Joan money? Raise your hands.
All right.
Wow. Take that. Wow. Take that.
All right. Okay. How many of you have given me money? Avant Guild members here? Well, that's there not so go. Bad. All right. A few.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's membership. It's love. It's.
What about Ricky? How many of you have given Ricky money?
What?
No. All right. How many of you have given The Onion money? Anybody? And Rufus, how many of you have given Rufus money? Wow.
All right.
See, we prefer to just give to the people. We're not trying to take.
You don't take.
Although for the price of a $20 latte, you can get access to
the onion
and
deep.
And actually, I think
onion.
This is a really good.
Too hot for.
Well, and just to complete the staff sizes, Ricky, you've got, what, 40-some people?
Yeah,
Rick,
40.
How big is your great. Staff size?
We have 40 people and 9 full-time editorial.
What about you?
Ask
and
me.
Sean, you've got something like
Sean,
that.
Sean, how big is your staff size?
I'm actually kind of insecure about the size of my staff. It's, we have 13 comedy writers and we have 8 entertainment writers. Actually, no, we have more than that. We have about 20, if you consider our local editors in every city where we have a newspaper.
Wow. That's
which
impressive.
Is an offline product.
It's very impressive. Rufus, how
yeah,
big
we,
is yours?
We have about 25 people for Nerve and Babble.
God, I'm understaffed.
You are.
Oh, all right, any of you want to work for me? Raise your hands.
You rely on freelancers too much, Laurel.
Yeah. And actually, I think the premium subject that came up is a really interesting one because it seems like there are a number of forces that have been pushing content, online content, I think, away from premium subscription, paid subscriptions, and towards free content. One is just the rise of ad revenue. There's just a lot more ad revenue here than there was a couple of years ago. And another is the increasing importance of natural search traffic and blog links, which I know that a lot of us here, I think we would have in retrospect made all of our written content free much faster, you know, had we known everything we know today. And I also think that everybody who publishes here publishes largely because, very significantly anyway, because we love what we publish. We like to reach people, and you really don't want to limit. I think nobody wants to limit the number of people who can read your stuff. But what do people think about? I think I think almost everybody here has tried some kind of premium paid subscription. I know it remains relatively central to Nerve, and of course it's not subscription for Salon, it's a membership. But what do people think about the trends with premium paid content?
I think it's kind of on the way out. I think as ad revenues move away from TV and print, you know, your business is going to be a lot more scalable if you're advertising based rather than subscription based.
And you leverage strategic platforms.
Strategically, we can do it.
Yeah. I would agree. We had a brief flirtation with a subscription model, and it was just, it made money. We didn't lose. It wasn't that bad. It just wasn't worth it. You can just do better with advertising and you open up more content to people. So it just seems like the best way to go.
I think you guys give up too easily. I think there's always going
to
be
nimble in this age of Web 2.0.
No, but I think you should have a hybrid model. I think you should always have extra, really special stuff for people who are willing to pay. And then you should have a lot of free stuff for people.
But why just do that for the sake of doing it? Or I mean, if you can make more money and give people more content, why would you just...
Well, I think, I mean, advertising is cyclical. And so for us, you know...
We've been through more than you.
We're older, Sean. I'm older.
I was through .com.
He was
Holocaust.
Where in high school?
I remember it.
He was. Where? I saw.
It was horrible.
I saw him there.
It was just
selling his chairs and his foosball table. It was.
I've seen your Aeron chair, Joan. It's fancy. Herman.
No, but seriously, it is cyclical. So I don't think we'll see anything like the bust that we saw before. But it will come and go to some extent. And you know, our membership program now, and we genuinely call it that and think about it that way. They are our most loyal readers, users. They have a lot to say to us. We think of it also kind of as a media club because we're always giving away new magazines, new books, DVDs. It's an important part of our business model at this point. But for now, at least, we've brought down all the barriers to getting to read the content that was not working. But I can't say that we would never, do what Laurel does and have some, subscription only or members only content. I mean, I do think you have to be nimble. And
I mean, it makes sense coming from where, you know, coming through that, you know, time when ad revenue declined and it was a smart way to try to figure out. But if you were starting a publication today, would you also have that into the business model or would you just be free and ad supported?
Our publications aren't, I don't think of our publication as a publication. I think of it as a community. And
yeah, it's,
I
it's think not this, a publication, is it?
Right. There's some of it. Okay.
You, what are you doing? What are you doing here?
Oh God. Rufus.
Oh, no.
How many people think it's a pub? No.
No, I mean, when I started out, I will admit this. When I started out, there was no editorial content, but the users demanded it. They wanted us to weigh in on important subjects such as how to get ahead in your freelance life. so we added that. But I think it's important to make a distinction here. I think the old model is broken. I think online magazines shouldn't have subscribers necessarily, but have members. And I like what Joan said about offering them more than just stuff to read and pushing it out there, but offering them other wonderful benefits. We offer health insurance for our freelancers. We offer what?
We do not offer health insurance for your $35. I'm sorry.
No. We offer access to group health insurance. We offer... a lot of classes and seminars and things like that.
And I mean, there are other ways of getting people who are fans of your site to pay you money other than content. Like I know we do t-shirts, and that's been a big part of our revenue. And The Onion also does merchandise as well. Ours is probably funnier and better. But,
does it just say College Humor Dick below it? Like, what does it say?
It's what we say called Busted Tees, which is a bunch of funny slogans.
Slogans, yeah. Okay.
Funny slogans?
Like funny haha.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah, that was a good idea for a... I hate you, College Humor. Bastard. So young.
I think that's an interesting question for everybody. I'll say one thing to follow up on the premium thing is that for Nerve, we now charge only for access to the racier photography on nerve.com. And we've got about 22,000.
Can you show some on the screen, maybe?
Yeah, actually, let me get that going there. Yeah, let's get. Wow. Yeah.
So Procter & Gamble doesn't want to sponsor that?
Be sure to click on the ad. I got to click on the ad.
Whoa. That's quite mad.
But it's actually worked well for us because it insulates our advertisers from the racier content and also is an extra source of revenue. But we've made the shift towards making everything free. We launched a new online magazine, babble.com, in December, and everything's free. And we're going to launch our third online magazine this coming December, and everything on it will be free. So we've definitely made a decision as a company.
Well, what's Babble about? Is it about lexicographers or something?
It was so nice of you to ask, because even though I'm supposed to keep these guys from boosterism and self-aggrandizement, I don't know who's keeping me from doing that. No, Babble's a magazine for urban parents, and you can see actually on the subject of kind of new stuff that the center of it is a blog that's up. We have 10 bloggers blogging all day long, video on the right hand side. So it's really very much it's been a lot of fun to start from scratch and re-envision what an online magazine would look like, and video and blogs are very central to it, as I think they are for a lot of these other publications. But on the subject of t-shirts, and you know, books are a key part of our business. Like we're publishing 10 books in the next 2 years.
Do you make money off the books?
Yeah, I mean, it's not, as a percentage of total revenue, it's not humongous, but it adds up. Mm-hmm. And how critical or how significant for your businesses are what I'd call brand licensing, whether it's books, t-shirts, you know, what have you?
Should I go first?
Yeah, you can go first. My answer
since I was
be better,
first.
So.
I think that it's important. Advertising is by far our biggest revenue opportunity, but we do books. We have a new original book coming out this year since we are boostering now, which is going to be a world atlas, which will be really fun. And we have a... it's probably 80% of our money comes from advertising, maybe 85%. It's only going up. So,
and is the other 20 from books and brand licensing, or is there other categories?
It's here? It's everything from personals to merchandise to licensing. And we don't really license content that often, but things like that. Yeah.
We went through the internet holocaust and
that
survived.
That is so inappropriate. I just say that. It's the internet 9/11.
We went through it and survived it because we had a different kind of business model from the beginning. We never had ad sales, meaning banner ads and stuff, supporting us. So we started out with job listings. And when those started crashing, we added classes and seminars and the membership, which is Avant Guild. And those things have just grown since then. And that's really most of our business model. And we just added ad sales this last year, and it's doing really well. So that's my story.
Yeah, we don't do that much with licensing. We've done a few books. We do them for love in general, not so much money. And it's mainly advertising, although our premium membership is still, I think, about a quarter of our revenue.
How many people currently subscribe?
Just over 50,000.
That's great. Good for you.
We basically consider everything offline, kind of a break-even brand extension marketing. We've published two books, and we have a deal at Paramount that we're working on a College Humor branded movie. But we don't even consider those, part of the business plan. It's just kind of, it helps when you go into an advertiser's office and you can say, hey, here's a book. Kind of makes you more legit.
Yeah.
Those advertisers, they like physical things, don't they?
And yeah, it's nice, yeah, to give people something when they come for a meeting. I find that's nice with the books. And Ricky, but wasn't my recollection is that t-shirts were really critical to you guys at the outset, right? That was one of your key early sources of revenue, right? And then advertising came later.
When we were, when we were too small to get, when we had traffic, but we couldn't get advertisers because we were, you know, a bunch of kids, we created our own advertising. We said, you know, well, let's make our own product and sell it on our site. And so that's where Busted Tees came from, and it caught on, and, you know, sooner or later it became half of our revenue. And it's still a significant chunk of it.
So he was lying before. You caught him, Rufus.
Very good. Lying about what?
About how it wasn't so significant to your business.
No, that's the, I mean, that's like the College Humor branded stuff. This is a separate.
Okay.
Yeah, no, you're right, Lou. I got to keep a close eye on this guy.
Good that you explained that.
It's tense up here. Maybe we should open up to the audience.
Yeah, I do think.
I don't think this
well,
is going
well. I do think that there's
it's
just,
not sexual
there's
tension
so
anymore.
Much.
It was.
There's so much for us to cover that please do feel free to come on up to the mic whenever you're ready. We'll start including questions in our discussion.
Okay. Uh-oh. My name is Matthew Fullhammer, and I just have 8 questions that I wanted to ask to the panel. Before I do the moment of silence, I wanted to say that if you hear my voice trembling, it's not because I'm nervous. It's because I... It's because I had a smoothie downstairs and it was cold and I'm still cold. If you think I'm just making that up to be stupid, here's the umbrella as proof. First question. Oh, no. To start though, I would like to take a brief moment of silence to gather my thoughts.
And Jake, how many questions do you have for us?
My name's Matthew and I have 8 questions to ask. First question came to mind when Sean Mills mentioned the long tail. There was a phenomenon that occurred in the Lower East Side of Manhattan in the 90s in which a very small group of hip people wore hush puppy shoes.
The topping point? The topping point, I think it's
this
called.
Is, it's it was Blink. On, it was
I
on
think
the
you're talking
side.
About Blink. There was like practically a whole book about the topping point. Yeah.
Well, so what happened was this small group of people who was wearing hush puppies, it caught on and it became a national trend. So I was wondering about that. Ideally, if you could just let me finish the questions and then answer all 8 of them. Second one is for Sean Mills from The Onion. I wrote a few headlines for The Onion and I just wanted to see what you
pitch
consider
pitch
them.
Do you have them here?
Area man can't decide which type of Captain Crunch to get, which is because there's...
There's like two. I mean, how would you...
but sometimes they have 3. They do like a Christmas. So there's that. Can everybody hear me?
Is the sometimes mic- the satir- yeah. The satirical point on that one's a little too sharp. So...
What do you mean?
There's a book called The Wisdom of Crowds. Are you familiar with it? Next question.
Yeah, I guess in New York, it's okay to just treat people like a piece of shit. To be like a smug asshole is fine, but I... President Bush...
next headline.
Next headline. President Bush makes a pronunciation error. Hello? We're being lied to by the president... Area man
like
plays.
That. I like that.
Area man plays Xbox 360 for only 2 hours.
Because you would play for a lot.
You hire this
right.
guy,
right? Right.
Yeah, you're good.
And this one actually happened to me. Area man gets 19 nuggets in a 20 pack from McDonald's. but
that sounds like something for your lawyer rather than for the Onion.
Area man. Who is the area man anyway?
Who isn't the area man?
My third question. Is
is Andy Kaufman here?
Okay, let's put our hands together.
Incarnated Andy.
Let's put our hands together for Jake Gladwick.
Could I come up afterwards after the panel and talk?
Yeah, you can talk to us afterwards.
Okay,
absolutely. Jake is the head of IT for College Humor, by the way.
You'd never know it.
Clearly trying to sabotage the Onion.
Is Jake one of your friends?
Clearly.
Yeah, please.
Morning, everybody. Yeah. Interesting kind of mix of phenomenal brands up there. And now you have to accommodate some of these user-generated content. You've talked about how you're allowing people to post elements on your post things on your website. And the notion of moderation came up earlier. I'm considering what are the moderation policies and how did you go about thinking about moderation on each one of your individual sites and how you've kind of managed to connect your brand to your community in that fashion and still kind of protect yourselves from things getting out of control, difficult things being said.
Next
question.
One way we kind of moderate who can post and who can't is, you know, just like the Facebook model, we require an EDU address. And so being a college website, you know, we can do that. It would be harder to do it for, you know, general sites. And then we have, you know, we have questions of, you know, is this appropriate? Is this too hateful? And we established, you know, basic rules of thumb, like for if we're wondering if something's like too offensive, that the rule is it more angry than it is funny? And if it is, then we'll delete it. So it's there are a lot of gray areas. It's an ongoing process, but we've been pretty successful moderating outside posts.
We say we take their angry ones over at Salon. They send them the angry people over at Salon. They're more welcome there. You know, we've done, as I said, very light moderation. We're going to be requiring an email and an authentic, I think is the word, email address in the next few weeks, actually. But because we really want to encourage at least a little bit more of people having at least consistent handles, if not their own names, more of a dialogue. Right now, we reserve the right to pull things down for any reason, and we rarely use it, like I said. We have pretty great readers, so the quality is reasonably high. When we get a complaint, we look at it. And then we do editor's choice picks, so that if you want to see what we think the good letters are, we give you a little red star, which is very controversial. And we'll be adding user moderation relatively soon as well, so users can tell other users, we think this is a great letter. So we've kept it to a minimum, and it's worked for us so far.
And actually related to that, how many people on the panel have had experiences with writers calling up or emailing in tears, basically, and saying like this, you know, this feedback has butchered my article and they're just distraught about it and want to take the whole thing down. Have you gotten that?
Yes. That's all I'll say. Just a yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is tricky. I mean, I know that for us at nerve.com, I mean, for years, you know, you have these writers who will spend weeks and weeks pouring their hearts and souls into like a extremely personal, you know, essay about their lives. That's a big risk for them. And then basically some people come up and say, this is a crock of, this is, you know, pathetic dribble. And, you know, and often they'll be big deal writers too, Pulitzer Prize winners. And it's a difficult.
I mean, speaking about 9/11, which Sean apparently thinks is a joke, and I don't.
College Humor does not think 9/11 is a joke.
And College Humor doesn't either. Yeah. Only Sean thinks that's funny. We literally had a story about 9/11.
You know something, Joan? No, we made America laugh after 9/11. What did you do? One conspiracy theory after another.
That's fair. That's true. That's true, Sean. I'm going to have to think about that. Thank you. Thanks for bringing that up. No, we had a really heartbreaking story about a family who lost a mother. And some readers, not our nice, smart readers, the angry readers that Ricky sent us, just wrote, you know, mean things about these poor 9/11, this poor 9/11 family. And the grandmother wound up writing in too. And then people came to her defense. And so I don't always feel this way, but mostly I feel like the community does moderate itself, and people, if people are getting really out of control and cruel, other people come in and try to even things out. But there are definitely bad days.
And it seems to me that writers are also just getting educated over time. This is just part of the new world, and they have to toughen up and deal with it, really. And one related question, by the way, that I think was an important one on our list is how, I think it was a great last question, is how, is to what extent the user-generated content that we have and all the different forms that we have make it difficult to have a consistent, coherent voice for your publications as a brand. Is that an issue for you guys?
For us, it really isn't. We were, you know, we have this kind of Animal House tone, and we've had that from the very beginning. And the site was built on user-generated content, and the editorial layer didn't come till after. So we got a sense for our community and exactly who they were and what they wanted. And then from that, we were able to, you know, have a consistent voice, you know, of topics that would, that they would find funny and that would apply to them. So it hasn't been a problem at all for us.
Ricky, this was your question, man. You told me that I thought this was going to be a big traumatic thing for you. No, that's great.
Big problem,
no, I'm
right,
kidding,
Ricky?
I'm kidding.
Big problem.
Okay. And also, I think it helps, you know, to have a centralized, like we talked about before, the benefit of having a full-time staff. And it helps to have, you know, 1 to 3 people who are always there and, you know, kind of can serve as, you know, the moderators of the voice or tone of your site. You know, if it's just kind of scattered throughout a bunch of freelancers with no central hub, you know, it's hard to establish a consistent tone.
Yeah. I mean, I've been so surprised at how high the level, not so much on the Onion, but on here, I'll take it. We have a site called the AV Club, which I mentioned before. And the level of, this is just an entertainment publication, but the level of discourse on the comments has been shockingly good, to the point where we have reached out to people that have commented and tried to hire them as writers because it requires almost no moderation. So we've just been pleasantly surprised. We haven't done that on the Onion. There's definitely a lot more reticence to open that up to commenting and things like that for some of the reasons you described. And just, but I've just been consistently impressed with how good the commenting is. And so, it's not inconsistent with the editorial voice at all. And it's also not, it's clear what's editorial and what's community and commenting. So it doesn't really, it just sort of adds to it. It doesn't really take away from it.
But it's interesting that you don't allow commenting on the Onion proper, because it's, but I've noticed the New York Times, for instance, doesn't allow comments directly to articles. And there's really a very limited number of publications that I think don't allow commenting.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little different because it's not real news, where, so in this, it makes a lot more sense. But if it's, you know,
Wait,
I don't know
real
what your
news?
Comments
are. That is true.
Yeah.
But what are you afraid of, Sean? What are you afraid of?
A lot of things.
So next question. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Andre. I work for Technorati. And I was wondering if you guys could talk a little more about the relationship between blogs and online magazines. In particular, I'm curious about how many of your readers actually go through your homepage and kind of their experience starts at your magazine versus how many come through links from blogs and just arrive straight at articles already kind of in a discussion that started elsewhere.
That's a great question. What do you do at Technorati? Do you want a job?
I'm a software developer there.
Cool.
We get about 75% of our traffic comes straight to Salon, either bookmarks or they type it in, which is, I think that's pretty high. I don't
very
know.
High.
You know, because we've been around for a long time, but blogs are an increasing part of our traffic, as I said before.
I would agree with her about her site. Very good. My site, totally different. A lot of our traffic comes to the homepage. A lot of it is bookmarked straight to the job board, believe it or not. So, like, I guess those people are looking for jobs. And a lot of people go straight to the blogs that we own. There are 7 of those. So those people just go to those blogs. Sometimes they never even come to MediaBistro.com.
Yeah, it's been a big and certainly growing part of how we get traffic, which is, it's really the best way. I mean, it's...
What is the best way?
I love when, you know, just... It's marketing by, you know, having your content live out there and get its own life and people discuss it. And so that's, I love that. I mean, I do think, you know, sort of the difference between, I mean, what makes you kind of a branded content channel, is a,
BCC.
Is that people do come to your homepage too. I mean, there are a lot of sites out there that just get traffic through other means. And so I think it's important to have both, but it's important to really kind of free up the content as much as possible.
Wait, do you guys have your own blogs on the Onion or no, not really, right?
We do have some, but we have much more on the AV Club. Okay.
And I would say for our properties that for on Nerve, we've got about a dozen blogs and that's become an increasingly, a lot of our traffic growth is in the blog area. And for the new online magazines that we're creating for Babel, it's, you know, it's right in the center of the page. And I think that's a model that we're going to continue to have in the next online magazines that we launch.
Which you won't tell us what it is, will you?
No, I won't. No. But it's roughly,
it
for Babel, you know, which is a young site, but traffic growing about 50% a month. It's, about half of the traffic is to the blogs. And so we see it very central. Thank you. Next question.
Hi, Sean, you said you've thought about hiring some of your readers. Why not just let the best stuff go on to the front page? I mean, have any of you guys thought about letting your readers go ahead and stand shoulder to shoulder with the journalists? My name's Christina Woodkey. I'm co-founder of a CMS for online magazines that does happen to do that. So I'm personally interested.
Okay. At our site, we do that. We have anyone
that was directed towards me.
No, I want to answer that. I want to answer that.
Thank God we're on opposite sides of this table, Ricky, because I swear. No, go ahead, sorry.
Okay, yeah. I mean, our site, we do that same exact thing. Anyone with a registered account, we have 500,000 registered users, and any one of them can post an article. And if they write an article, it'll go directly to our editor, and if it's good enough, it'll go straight to the front page.
But they're all about the same subject, right? Dicks.
Yeah. There's some vagina articles in there, but mostly dicks.
So
it's just not as funny.
No. Yeah, I mean,
not as funny.
Vagina jokes? I beg to differ.
Only when they're monologues. Only when they're monologues. All right.
Yeah, well, we've had a really organic process of discovering new comedy writers, specifically comedy. And it's not to open it up. We haven't done that. We just kind of feel like, you know, if you're a talented comedy writer, kind of by sheer force of your own creative will, you're going to reach out, you're going to send us stuff. And so it's easier to just say it's unsolicited and we don't, you know, accept submissions. But of course, you know, people do send us things and we look at it. We haven't figured out the best way to like open that up. And it's kind of breaking character in a way for The Onion. I mean, our editorial motto is tu stultus es, which means you are dumb. So we've always been, you know, we tell you what to think about things. We don't want to hear from anyone. Obviously,
that's so old school. That's like push, push, push. Why don't you? I like his idea.
Actually, it's 3.0.
Her idea.
It's an interesting 3.0. Question that she just asked. And I think that for most of these sites, I mean, like for Salon, for instance, Joan, I mean, I'm imagining that unsolicited submissions make up a very small percentage of what you publish on Salon. Is that the case? I mean, most of what you publish is you commission.
You know, it's more than you'd think, Rufus, really, because we have great readers and we actually get a significant number of unsolicited pieces in the course of a month that, you know, just impress an editor. But to speak specifically about user-generated content, not a submission, I mean, we've put a reader letter on the cover. We've put a collection of letters on the cover. You know, we've decided that on any given day, that's the best content or that's the most interesting thing in Salon when everybody else is kind of off their game or I don't know what they're...
It's been a bad day.
After the holiday party or something. No, because it's good. But we still do at this point. You know, we're the editors and we decide that. We're not at this point... having users create their homepage, but I see that coming. You know, I see that coming in the not too distant future.
And it's certainly true for us that we're doing more and more user generated content. And I think my view is that in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years that you'll see more and more of a hybrid model of somewhere in between. I think that pure user generated just through ratings and sorting through ratings and popularity, like on Digg, is fantastic for certain environments. But I think the combination of having an editorial team and user-generated content is particularly powerful. So you think of like American Idol, you know, how successful would the show be without the judges? You know, probably less successful. And so I think the combination of the democratic effect and you know, editorial insight is probably...
That's a good point.
Yeah, I think Nerve is really the American Idol of the internet in a lot of ways.
Thank you, Sean. That's what I was driving at. I'm glad. Boosterism is a collective activity.
Does that make Rufus Simon?
Yeah.
Or Paula.
Next.
Larry Smith.
Larry.
Good to see you.
Thanks. Hi, Larry.
Well, it's interesting that you just said that. And in the spirit of this thing, maybe you'd put up smithmag.net up there.
Very good.
That wasn't audience, my question, but you know, the spirit of the panel here.
The memo that I got didn't address audience boosterism.
That is indeed, but that is exactly what we do. So smithmag.net. And before I ask my two very different questions, I wanted to mention on the letters and the moderated question, there was a fantastic article on Salon about all this that Gary Kamir wrote that I just think anyone's interested in. It was sort of explains it all really well, and it's very funny. It's a good-looking site. So my questions are two.
Hold a seat.
One is, nobody invited me, but maybe next year. How do you deal with when you have stories that become other products, books, maybe movies, TV shows, and probably a freelance writer. In the case, how do you deal with sort of the contracts, and if something happens, how do you pay them? And the second question I have is very different, which is, what have you tried that didn't work? Just matter some part of your site. Like when do you know to pull the plug? It's like you love it, but it's not working, but sometimes you got to give it more time. So if you guys have case studies on that, I'd love to hear that.
Okay. Third or fourth questions?
That's all okay. I have. Just leave the site up for a little while, though.
200 new unique users.
We'll take it.
Who wants to take that?
The first question, I think, I celebrate that if that happens. It hasn't really happened to us a lot, but a story turns into some other product, in which case, I mean, I don't have like a template for the contract, but I would say that's usually, you know, if you're a brand, it's usually going to be a more valuable product if it's under the brand, but there's a way to really reward, your writers and editors, and, you know, above and beyond. For those types of projects. So I think it's really a partnership. It's, you know, it's not like, great, well, you wrote it while you were working for us, therefore we're going to go exploit it in X, Y, and Z way. I don't think that's the right way to do it.
That's what we do, actually.
Is it really?
Yeah. No. No, but it's in our contract. You've signed our contract, Larry. In fact, I own smithmag.net. I don't know what you're doing.
Best of luck to you. Everything you do is ours.
So I don't understand this, how this happened. But yeah, we have a contract and we, you know, build in participation, and we negotiate case by case when things like this happen.
How much participation do you give your writers?
It varies totally.
What does participation exactly mean? Like, what could it
mean? You know, HBO bought somebody's story a few years ago to make a movie that I don't think it's been made, but we shared quite well with that person.
So basically, Joan, you guys own film rights, but share the revenue with the writer.
Right.
Right. Yeah, we have a similar contract.
Ours is more like a standard magazine contract because none of our writers are ever going to get film deals for their articles.
and Larry's second question was, what have people done that has failed? And I'm sure that everybody here, having narrowly survived the crash, capital T, capital C, you know, I know that all these sites have been through dozens of different features and business models, and a lot of them haven't worked. Many of them have. Do any things jump out in your minds of things that have failed?
That we'll admit to?
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. I want to hear yours. What have you failed at?
Some of the hardest questions I've ever been asked. I mean, it didn't fail, but the paid subscription model is something that we scrapped briefly.
Wait, if it didn't fail, why did you scrap it?
Just because it was more valuable to advertising, just was better of the two.
It failed.
Editorially, I'm not really sure what, you know, we've play around sometimes with how real time and how quick and how much we want to participate in this sort of 24-hour news cycle of comedy. And I think we've sort of backed off that sort of philosophically, and it's a little more about sort of the polished stone theory of, you know, start with a big list of ideas and work it down, and don't worry about, you know, making an Anna Nicole joke the next day. But you try some of those things editorially and you see what you can do. But I guess I don't really have another answer than that.
Oh, that's good.
It's a really good question. I think that a lot of the things that we cut in the days that we were cutting back, it wasn't that they weren't good. It was just that we couldn't afford to keep doing them. Now, at a time when we're growing again, and you know, it's still tight, so we're still sometimes having to cut things in order to add other things. And you can't let traffic be the main reason you do something, you know. But that's very tough when you see, you know, if we did all Anna Nicole, all Britney, all dick humor like some people all the time, you know, traffic would be a lot higher. Darfur is not, you know, if you see Africa on our cover one day, you know that we're going to take a traffic hit for that. But I think things do require patience and the belief of an editor sometimes.
Yeah, I'm pretty unwilling to say anything much has failed. We tried to make a huge launch into LA for our classes and seminars, and we definitely have not seen the tremendous boom in LA that we saw in New York. So
So it was a failure.
Well, we're pulling back a little bit on that.
That sounds like the Secretary of Defense.
Mistakes were made.
So to clarify, The Onion, Media Bistro, and Salon have all done things that have failed.
I mean, and so it's such a good question because really by not having something that failed, I feel like that's almost a fact. I mean, it means I didn't try enough stuff. So it's a great question.
What about Ricky?
We've been getting into making original short form video lately over the past 6 months. And, you know, that's been the big experiment in failure because, as a whole, it's been successful, but individual videos, you know, that we've put, you know, weeks of effort in and thousands of dollars into, you know, some of them had just bombed and it's frustrating. You know, you think we did this one video. No question.
You should.
Okay. It was this one video and it was like, it's called The Truth About Ronald McDonald. And Ronald McDonald, comes home from a day of work and he checks his answering machine. There's a message from Grimace and goes upstairs and he wipes the makeup off and it turns out he's a black guy. And we're like, oh, this would be great. Everyone would love this. And bomb, total bomb. I guess from your reaction, I can tell why.
What was funny about it.
Well, if you had seen the video, it was.
I mean, does everyone assume that Ronald McDonald is a white guy? Raise your hands if you assumed Ronald McDonald was a white guy.
We're hoping to get a cease and desist from McDonald's that said, like, Ronald McDonald is not a black guy. But it wasn't popular enough.
It's not too late.
Thanks.
I don't know where it is. Yeah, but on a micro level, clearly, though, it's one of the great things about being online is that you can measure what what the audience likes and doesn't like really quickly. And so I'm sure that's true for everybody here that you put up a video, you put up a new column, and if people aren't responding to it, you know, you have very immediate feedback, which is, I think, a great advantage of being online. Yeah. Next question.
Hi. So a lot of your sites have blogs on them now, and you have bloggers integrated into your content. How do you deal with the fact, and there's probably a lot of different ways of doing it, how do you deal with the fact that a lot of bloggers want to have their own blog as well, and they want to
sort of tear their time between,
you know, do I write for my own blog? Do I write for the blog that's paying me that has more traffic? Or how do you structure contracts around those kinds of things?
One of our former bloggers is here, actually, because of that very problem. Where are you, Garrett? Just kidding. No, it's a problem. I mean, he was here, I swear.
He left angry.
No, psychologically, I just hate the idea of someone, you know, creating the same identical content on a separate blog. But it's hard because if you're not... are you talking about people who are full-time blogging for us or part-time?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it just seems like a writer who has a blog or maybe even they were a blogger before they became like a writer and before they became a writer for magazines. And maybe they like that lifestyle better, but they're tempted by the sort of imprimatur of having a magazine.
An old school dominatrix. I like to, you know, own my employees. I don't like them to be freelancing even on their own and creating traffic for themselves. I feel like that energy should be put on our side. And I'd rather pay more for that than.
Well, how do you convince the blogger of that?
You have to pay them. Yeah. Which we don't do. So we don't have that. We pay them a normal salary, but I mean, we don't pay them extra not to do that, but that's probably the way to do it.
We actually have the exact opposite philosophy, which is that on Stroller Derby, which is our Babel blog, we've got like 8 or 9 of the top parenting bloggers blogging for this blog, and all of them have their own blog about parenting.
Wait, do you pay them though?
Yeah, we pay them. Yeah, we sure do. And we find and we get a lot of traffic from their blog. So I think from our perspective. It seems to me that full-time bloggers very often have multiple blogs these days and that it redounds to our benefit for them to do
Wait,
so.
How
so
do we, you get that, their it. Traffic from their blog to your site?
Well, because they naturally link to what they're doing on their other blogs. I think there tend to be a lot of links between, you know, people's blogs. So, Laurel, you might reconsider that approach.
Yeah. All right. Fine.
Anybody else? Is that something you've encountered, Joan?
You know, it really it isn't. We keep people way too busy to have their own blogs. So,
school, another one.
Well, I mean, some sites they co-opt the blogger completely. Like, and you know, Andrew Sullivan is now a wholly owned subsidiary.
Well, and we just took on Glenn Greenwald. But you know, Andrew still freelances. I don't, and Glenn is free to.
But they don't blog elsewhere.
They don't have another separate blog called Andrew Sullivan 2.
Right.
No.
Right.
See, that's wrong. Yeah, I think that's wrong. He should just do it for who he's paid to do it.
So, guys, we only have about 5 minutes left. So,
we need better questions. Okay.
Next question. That was a good question.
No, I'm teasing.
I'm not going to give you a better question, but
I'm just teasing.
I've been nursing a hangover since Friday morning. It's been continuing.
Go on.
I'm a designer over at Austin360Statesman.com here, the main online newspaper here in town. And do y'all have your own?
Oh yeah.
Do y'all have your own design staffs, or you have people that create designs, or a lot of for the ads, or is a lot of that stuff external?
That's a good question.
Yeah, we have a design staff. I think the investment in design is like one of the best investments you can make, and it makes such a difference every time you do something new. The more you can put into the design, I think it just makes a huge difference. So yeah, we have some great design staffs, and
we've
worked with outside.
What about the online ads?
Companies. In fact, I believe the last question was asked by a guy that did a lot of our site architecture and stuff. So absolutely helpful to sometimes bring in experts.
How many people do you have creating design?
We have 3 web designers.
And Rufus, how
many
do you
have? We have designers in every city.
We now have 3 full-time and 2 part-time, but that's partly because we're launching new websites, but we found design to be one of the things that doesn't scale as you launch new websites. It takes a lot of designers to create a new website from scratch, which we did. I mean, Nerve evolved over years and years, but to create Babel from scratch with several hundred pages, it took, you know, 3 or 4 months of like 4 people working at it. It was a lot of work. But I agree with what Sean said, that I think one of the reasons that online magazines or BCCs or whatever you want to call them, I think are growing and have a key place, is that they are these designed, very visually attractive environments. Opposed to, I think blogs are amazing at what they do, but I think that's something that, you know, these publications bring is the design.
We found that it was hiring a good designer was harder, the hardest job to hire. It's easier to get a designer, but a good designer, was very tough. Yeah. And also, as a side note, The Onion won't hire women designers as a policy.
Yeah.
Do you have any women working?
I've heard that.
It's not necessarily women, it's minorities.
of any sort.
And do you have any women working for you?
No, we've tried. We've tried. They're lazy.
So, and not
you live
funny.
And you learn. That was one of those failures.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Next question.
Hi. I talked to this guy and we have a similar question. So maybe if you don't want to chime in.
Yeah. Good, together.
Good. Team up. Tag team.
It's a format question. So you keep referring to it as a magazine and a publication and a cover page and things like that. But there are definitely differences between a website and a magazine. So that's the first part. And I want to find out what you do to keep it a magazine and then, and use that term. And then secondly, I don't know if you're familiar with these new formats where your Zinio or some of your magazines are coming in these PDFs or these flash-based formats, and they're actually formatted to look like a magazine. Have you ever considered that, and what do you think are the benefits and the downsides of that format?
I mean, I think you started off by saying, like, we don't really even refer to, most of us don't refer to our sites as magazines.
Only when we're talking to advertisers.
And,
okay, well, that's key. I mean, that's important. And you talked earlier about like advertisers wanting something physical to hold. So how do you overcome that? We're a magazine, but we're not a magazine. We're a website, but we're not a website. Who do you talk to even when you go to advertisers? Do you talk to the agency's print marketing people or the web people?
Many, I mean, there are online marketing people now. And so we've never really had the advertisers need something to hold, feeling, you know, we're original to the web. They know who we are and what we do. And we've done a lot of innovative things, to work with our advertisers in terms of very creative ad units. So I don't consider us a magazine. I'm happy. If you want to call us a magazine, I'm happy.
The title of the cinema.
I know. We already battled Rufus. Yeah. You should have heard the fighting before.
Well, then what do you,
we're a website.
I mean, we think people can understand. Yeah, it's a website. Okay. You don't have to compare it to
something else.
We say we're a community.
And things like that. I mean, you probably all your freelancers are published in other magazines more than maybe websites?
Not so much anymore.
Really?
You know, I mean, I think it's less of a problem for me than it once was, to think about what we are. I mean, I'm happy to call us a website, you know, and we're something really original to the web. And that's a benefit
If you're trying to recreate the magazine experience on the internet, you're sort of not taking advantage of what you can do on the internet. And so it's better off to
think of
it as
something
else.
So have you seen any of these magazines that are trying to do that, trying to put the magazine experience and make it interactive with
videos?
That's
crazy. Crazy.
Really? I've never seen anyone actually reading that. I've heard of it, and honestly, I've never actually seen people using it.
I've heard that Playboy does it successfully in overseas because it's harder to ship an actual physical Playboy. So you can send this PDF of all the sexy pictures overseas, and they've done that.
The counter argument that I would make, I'm a little fonder of the. I'm sort of torn on this subject because I personally have really positive associations with magazines. I love the browsing experience and what a rich visual experience it is. Right. And also from a business perspective, there is $24 billion a year of ad revenue in the print magazine business that's gradually eroding and decaying and flowing online over time, I think. So I think we weren't a magazine?
We are a magazine. $24 billion. We're a magazine.
Talking to the advertisers. Yeah. But, you know, and there's something about also a sort of coherently branded experience that's part of a magazine that I think is true of all of these publications. So I think we're still figuring out what to call it.
It was Rufus's title for this panel. We really didn't know what he was talking about.
I mean, I like it. There are a few definitely digital only magazines that are coming out now, and some of them are better than others, but it's a whole new interesting world of actual online magazines laid out like a magazine, but it embeds video or it's got links to other sites, or I don't know if you've ever considered doing that.
I was going to ask really quickly, like The Onion started as a print publication obviously and then became wildly popular online, and I notice now you're printing in Austin as well.
Yeah.
And so has Salon or any of the others considered doing an online component or counterpart to their...
A print counterpart?
You mean counterpart? Yeah. We've thought of doing a newsletter.
I knew we'd done something stupid. I couldn't figure out what it was. we did put out a print magazine for a year, magazine, which I loved. It was beautiful. And I think that you always have to be suspicious of things that you love, you know. And it was one of the smartest things we ever did was shut it down. But I do think there's a place for that hybrid model. The Onion's done it really well. And actually, we are looking at doing some selective, like quarterly print scenarios, you know, backed by specific advertisers. Like I think we're likely to see more of that kind of thing, I think, in the next decade.
But I get asked all the time, like, why do we keep doing that? Why do we keep publishing newspapers? And we've expanded it a lot in the last few years. And it's still a great business for us. And it's still a great avenue to get local advertising, especially more than I think. I think it's local advertisers are getting a little more savvy about the internet, but I think print is still the dominant medium for that. And it's just... If I just looked at it as a profitable marketing department for The Onion and a way to build awareness of the brand and get people to come to the website and, you know, use video and be part of a community, things you'll never achieve in a print publication, then it's also worthwhile in that regard. So,
cool. Thanks.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's actually perfect timing. We're actually having collectively. You have a final question? No. Collectively, the companies on the panel are throwing a party tonight. We're trying to keep it very quiet. We're trying not to make sure that nobody hears about it. So I probably shouldn't mention where it is, but nonetheless, it's, seriously, 6:30 to 8:30 tonight at Club DeVille, open bar. Come on by. And thank you everybody. And have
thanks
a, great
a lot.
Time.
Aww,
thank you, Kevin.
And I just launched the-